Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and artists about the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very pleased today to have on my show Frank Palaya, an artist who lives nearby in Rhinebeck, New York. Frank has been on the program previously to talk about an exhibition of artists' books we had here in the Vassar College Art Library. And today he's here to talk about his mural art and his new catalog entitled Wall Works, Frescoes, Photo Sculpture, and Mixed Media, 1973 to 2021. Welcome back, Frank.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It's always nice to be with you.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show again. I should mention also, Frank is the husband of someone who works for Vassar in the art department, Eve Dombro.
So. Yeah, just a coincidence.
Although that may come up later, you know. Yeah. So. You also add with the catalog, the cover title, Catalog Raisonné. But this isn't a catalog of your complete life's work, only of your mural art. And you have, as I mentioned, artist books, photography, and works in other media. And that other media, which I notice you don't include in the catalog, actually includes mural arts. So when you entitle this Wall Works, it doesn't include the actual painting you've done on walls in town, right?
So yeah, Tom, I think you're confusing my murals, which is one thing, with this particular catalog, which I call Wall Works, because they are simulated walls that I've been making for about almost 50 years. The Wall Works is the title of just the works that are in this catalog, which is just a fraction of what I do. I actually, sometimes I feel like I'm about five or six different people because, I compartmentalize all the things that I do, although they're all kind of related. I mean, I'm a painter, a photographer, sculptor, a muralist, a curator, a public artist, book artist, you know, on and on, and musician. But anyway, but today we're talking about the catalog Raisonné. Now, I know it's not all of my artwork, because if I put everything that I do into a catalog, it would be about, you know, 4 inches thick. So I had to like compartmentalize the work. Yeah. In fact, the next book I make is going to be just my murals. Indoor murals, which is about 50, 56 murals. So that's a whole nother book. I have already done, over the years, I've done a Polaroid book of my SX70 Polaroids and my nightlife. This is the Polaroid book. And then this is the nightlife book, which is only about this particular series of photographs that I did in the early to mid 80s in New York City. I documented this artist's work, where street works, where he painted black shadows all over the world, actually. But I met him in the early 80s before he even started these. He told me what he was going to do. And then I felt almost obligated to photo document them. Because I knew that this would be an important series. In fact, now 40 years later, these are just as popular and just as in demand as when he did them 40 years ago. In fact, I have a show today, tonight, in Soho. I'm showing several large versions of these shadow photographs.
Yeah, and that's Hamilton.
It's amazing. 40 years later, and people are still clamoring for them. Today, the Wall Works is this catalog, and it's only about, like I said, my mixed media simulated urban wall constructions.
But you do mention Richard Hamilton in the Wall Works in passing.
Of course.
Because he's important to your notion of what you're doing. So,
Well, yeah, because it fits right into what I do with the Wall Works. I've been doing this for decades. I love to travel, and when I travel, I always photograph walls, murals, street art, graffiti, signs, posters, billboards, all that kind of stuff, because I find it fascinating, because every country you go to, what you see is different. You know, if you're in a country and there's all kinds of crazy things going on the walls, you're probably in a liberal democratic country. If you go to a country and the walls are spotless with not even a dot of anything on them, you know, you're probably in a dictatorship, or fascist country, because, of course, they don't allow things like that. In fact, when I was in China in 1981, I had given myself a project to photograph the walls, the billboards and all that. And there was not one spot of graffiti, because if you get caught in China in 1981, I don't know about now, literally, that you would really be punished.
Yeah.
Which is, it's some countries, it's still like that. I think Singapore is like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
Singapore, you can't.
Not New Jersey, though. Yeah. So,
yeah. So, but it's free speech. It's a little sloppy. It's a little ugly sometimes. But I think it's important to let people speak their mind, so to speak. Yeah. One piece of graffiti can change a whole government. If you come up with a slogan that people really catch on to and believe in, you could overthrow a government with one piece of graffiti. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't happen every day, but I think it's a real reflection of people in general. I have a saying that walls are the drop cloths of society. They kind of hold everything that people are thinking.
Uh-huh.
And it's right there. That phrase, the writing is on the wall.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, it's kind of true. The writing is on the wall, So anyway, I can go on. I hope I clarified the thing with you're calling it my mural.
Oh, yeah, sure. You did. And the interesting thing is this is so geographic. I mean, it's organized geographically. So I found it very interesting. You're doing a kind of geography here in a way, in that you're pulling in what you see and what you photograph, and then expressing something yourself that fits into what, what you're seeing in these various places, influenced by them. So, something flashed through my mind while you were talking there. Daumier, of course, when you were talking about the importance of graffiti and drawing, in his case, cartoons on politics, it was hugely important to the democratization of France in the 19th century. So,
actually, what got me inspired about walls is the cave paintings, because, as a student, I'm looking at the cave paintings and, 40,000 years ago, holy mackerel, these paintings, they're murals, you could call it graffiti or murals, but this is so, before language, before even the concept of art. There were no, art teachers, art supplies. They just came up with this activity that, we're the first living animals, mammals, to do anything like that. It's what made us, that point made us different from every other animal in the world, that we could make distinctive markings with our hand to portray an image that no other animal can do. And so that's a big deal. So, and as a muralist, I feel like I'm part of that tradition of humans making markings on walls that are meaningful.
We don't think of Lascaux as graffiti, do we, quite? But it, well, but in a way, kind, they have a lot of talent, don't they?
Yeah. But it's also murals, too. There's a little bit of a difference between graffiti and a mural. Sometimes they blend, sometimes they don't. Yeah, but that's it's the way it is. But I mean, those cave painters, they invented spray paint. They ground up pigments, colored pigments, put it in their mouth, put a straw in their mouth and blew it, put their hand up and made a stencil. You could see the hand images. I mean, that's inventing spray paint. They invented the stencil. Yeah. I mean, 40,000 years ago, it's just unbelievable.
Interesting. And children gravitate to this, don't they? They like to write on walls, as everyone with a child knows.
You know why?
You have to get them to stop it, because they will do it if
because it's a physical, natural thing. It's like we're vertical people. We're standing upright and a wall is up and down. So, and our eyes are here. So when we confront a wall, it's very obvious and easy. Oh, okay. I'm just going to mark this thing that's in front of me and it's a wall. Mm-hmm. So for millennia, that's what we've been doing. A painting is a little wall that you hang on a wall. It's all related. It's all kind of mushed together and it goes back tens of thousands of years. So I feel like I'm continuing this really ancient tradition. that makes us human.
So when did you first realize you were interested in walls? I mean, did it have to do with your realizing you wanted to be an artist at the same time?
Well, the cave painters, they impressed me immensely.
Yeah.
And I like to manipulate things, you know, when I can't just do a painting. I have to do other things to it. That's why I love frescoes, because they have texture, and I use mixed media because I love to mix things together. Nothing wrong with just a painting with paint on a canvas. Nothing wrong with that. It's just that I just have the urge to do more. And so that's why for years and years I've been doing artworks that have texture and materials, different materials and so forth.
So you take one step back, however. This isn't just, as you say, mural art itself, but these are simulated walls that you're working with now that you can you can exhibit in a gallery as sculpture, in a sense, and painting also. So can you talk about that a bit? I mean, the fact, how did this come about, and what are these things, you know? What are they made of?
So the wool works pieces, basically there are four mediums in each piece. They're paintings, they're photographs, they're sculpture, and they're even architecture, because some of them are quite big, and they look like a piece of a building that's ripped out of a structure and just placed in a gallery. But of course, they're all completely simulated from scratch. They're not real. They look, if I say so myself, unbelievably real, and other people can attest to that. Actually, everything is the opposite about them. These works, and I've been doing these for 45 years. They look real, but they're fake. They look heavy, but they're feather light. They look old, but they're brand new. I mean, just everything is the opposite with these works. And what I do is, like I said, I like to travel a lot, and wherever I go, I photograph walls and murals and street arts, etc. Then I come back and I kind of digest all the images and I rearrange them. And then I recreate the wall, simulate the wall. And I use, as a base, I use polystyrene or big pieces of styrofoam. Basically, they're insulation, 4x8 sheets of insulation. They come in different thicknesses, 2-inch, 4-inch, 6-inch. Some are even a foot thick. And so I use that material because I can manipulate it. I can break it, cut it, punch it, sand it, scrape it, you know, add things to it. And just like you could do with real masonry in a building, but of course, I don't want to do that. Yeah. I want to make my own version of these walls, obviously, so I don't break my back carrying them around. And also, that's the magic. You know, I like the fact that they're fake.
Yeah, it's artifice. It's not realism, right? Yeah.
I think, you know, artists are a little bit like magicians. You know, we kind of make things that are not real or they look real, but they're not, you know.
Yeah.
That's the kind of the nice little, like, mysterious thing about being an artist. You can make things that nobody has ever seen before. I mean, my walls look like came from somewhere, but when they sort of did, you know, the visual part. But the physicality of them is completely...
Well, galleries do that. They'll go out in the street and they'll take a Bansky and they'll pull the wall down and they'll drag it into the gallery.
Yeah, right. I don't really want to do that.
No.
So I'm the easy way out. I just make my own.
So then do you then emulate what you see as you travel around? And then in the beginning, maybe we should go, you know, right to your period that you call cave art. I mean, which is where this sort of starts. Do you emulate what you see?
Kind of. I guess I'm a vicarious way of being a graffiti artist. I'm not really a graffiti artist. I mean, I paint murals. I guess you could say that's street art, you know, but it's a little bit of a different kind of mural painting. Oh, and I forgot to mention one other thing that I do that fits into all this other stuff is I'm also a sign painter. Actually is what got me into mural painting, because I'm painting signs on wood and plastic and metal. And then I'm painting sometimes a sign on a wall, and the customer, the owner of the building would say, you know, Frank, I have a logo. Can you paint a logo? And I said, yeah, sure. I'm an artist. I'm not just a sign painter. because not all sign painters are artists and not all artists are sign painters. Anyway, I could do both. So I say, yeah, sure. So I would paint the logo or a cartoon character or a car or something. And I thought, you know, it's way more fun painting these characters and images than it is doing the lettering, because the lettering is so tedious and it has to be so perfect and it's kind of stressful, you know, but painting characters was a lot more fun. So I started looking for mural jobs, and that's how I got into mural painting from sign painting.
It does pay for tubes of paint too, doesn't it? I mean, it pays. Sign painting is a way of, you know.
I was at a graduate school and I didn't have any teaching jobs. It was during the oil embargo, if you remember, in the 70s. There were no jobs around. So I had to just figure out how to make some quick cash. So I figured, well, I have the brushes, I have the paint, I have a steady hand. So I started painting signs, and then after a while I got pretty good at it. I was making a decent amount of money, but I would separate the two activities. You know, today I'm doing a sign, tomorrow I'm going to make a painting. You know, I separated the two. And then I realized, you know, I could blend these two. And then I started incorporating my sign lettering into my wall works. And that was a great thing because it added a whole nother dimension to my, my paintings.
Yeah, you've got, let me see, is it the second period here, the American works? You've
yeah,
got
the American,
a lot of,
right.
yeah, the American series. Yeah, you've got
logos,
Texaco, Gulf. Actually right. it is the oil embargo. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you've got these wonderful images of advertisements, in a sense, that look like they've been there for decades, that are kind of chipped away. But it is very interesting. So you're commenting in a way on advertising itself.
Well, yes. And I also was not happy with the oil companies in the first place.
Okay. Yeah.
So by deteriorating their logos in my process of making these wall works, it was a little bit cathartic that, you know, I'm tearing down the oil company by ruining their logo by making this kind of decrepit, ruinous.
But on the other hand, it makes them look like they've been here since the Stone Ages, you know. So
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's part of it. That I want them to look old, like I was saying, but they're actually brand new.
Yeah.
And they only weigh like 4 or 5 pounds,
yeah,
even though they look like they weigh 700, 800, 900 pounds.
Yeah. I have seen, though, you do have old signs that you pulled into your studio, right? Did I remember like a Coca-Cola sign or something like that?
Yes. Well, yeah, I kind of collect old signs just because they're kind of beautifully done and they don't make them anymore. And because I'm a sign painter, I can appreciate the skill of making a sign.
Yeah.
You know, and there have been artists, musicians who have been sign painters. For example, Woody Guthrie was a sign painter. He'd always travel around the country. One hand he had his guitar and the other hand he had his little can of paint and brushes. So that's how he would make a living in between.
Then there is this period right about this time, a little before, of cross-fertilization between commercial art and fine art that Warhol actually capitalizes on in a huge way, or really advances.
He's a prime example of incorporating corporate logos. And
so was he an influence on you at this time at all?
You know, I think so. I think he's really... he's sort of a milestone, I think, in the line of contemporary art, because he was sort of a little bit of everything. You know, he was an artist. He was a great businessman. And he even says that it's one of his famous sayings, you know, the art of business is the best kind of business, or something like that. And then he capitalizes on these commercial images, boy, more than anybody that I could think of. So, yeah, I guess, and also he was versatile. I could relate to him because he was also a painter, a printmaker, a sculptor.
A movie maker.
Yeah, he did all kinds of things. And so I relate to people who do a lot of things because I like the challenge. I like, I get tired just doing one thing all the time. I like to mix things up a little bit.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Richard Hambleton shadows. Can you talk about those a bit and how you incorporate those into your work?
Well, yes. I met him in 1980 at a party in Elizabeth, New Jersey, of all places, where I was living. He had just come from Canada. He's a Canadian from Vancouver. He came to New York. The Canadian government was really generous with their artists. They would pay your rent. If you're an artist, a serious artist, they would pay your rent for years, no matter where you would live, because the Canadian government thought that it was promoting their country's artists, that to have them go throughout the world and do their work. So he took advantage of that and he said, all right, I'm going to New York. That's where the action is. So he was already kind of a street artist. He was doing conceptual street art in Canada. But then he came up with this idea and I saw him at this party. He was kind of a wallflower. He looked very awkward and shy. And I went over to talk to him and he confided in me. I don't know why. I only knew him for a few minutes. And forget the phone there.
Hello.
Sorry, a robocall. So anyway, he told me he's going to paint these black shadows all over the city. I said, wow, that sounds like a great idea. I was already photographing graffiti and walls, as I was saying before.
Yeah.
So this was right up my alley. So I asked him, would you mind if I photo documented your shadow paintings? And he says, yeah, sure, go ahead. So he would call me every couple of weeks to tell me where he did them because I wanted to photograph them when they were fresh and black. Mm-hmm. And pure, you know, there's a purity about them. You could see even just from the cover photo here, beautiful blackness. And he had these brush strokes that to me reminded me of Franz Klein, you know, very quick. It took him only maybe a minute to do one. And there was something about him. It wasn't your typical graffiti or street art. In fact, street art wasn't even a term then. This is 40 years ago, but they were so powerful. And once you saw them, you never forget them. They're just burned into your brain. And also, what I think, this is years later, I'm thinking, you know, why did he do this? I think it's because they were him. Mm-hmm. He was kind of painting himself.
They're
almost like self-portraits all over. And he did hundreds of these. Mm-hmm. I photographed, 150 of them, I think. There's 90 in my book here. Mm-hmm. So I think this is psychologically, subliminally, whatever. He was painting himself and he was saying, hey, New York, I've arrived. I'm here, you know, take a look, you know, deal with me. Here I am, you know, that kind of thing. Because he was very shy and quiet, but he was very bold in his activity, his art activity. And I tell you, they scared the heck out of everybody. In fact,
Well, there's something about a shadow that is so disturbing, isn't it?
Right. And this is in the early 80s when crime was very high in New York. And they're also life size. So you turn a corner and you see it, this black thing, and you're, you know, it just startles you. And that, I think that was the whole point. You know, he wanted to get your attention, and he certainly did. And he did them only at night. And that's why I called the book Nightlife. He only did them at night. He would wear all black, you know, and he would just have one brush and a little can of black paint. He would just, you know, very simple, but very effective. And I thought, wow, this is a brilliant idea. And he purposely kept himself kind of mysterious. Of course, he didn't talk about it. That's why I was amazed that he told me about it. So I had a head start and I started photographing. I think I was the first one to photograph them. Mm-hmm. And other people took pictures later on, but mine are, like I was saying, they're pure, they're black, they're clean. Mm-hmm. Then later on, other people did other things and put happy faces on them and arrows through the head and tuxedos, things like that. Yeah. But that's okay too. You know, it became an interactive kind of activity. But that's the story of Hamilton. And now he's as popular as ever. In fact, he's having a retrospective that opens tonight. It's in Soho in New York, and it includes three huge galleries.
Well, this is interesting to me as a librarian, because I can see an archival compulsion here in you, in a way, in that you wanted to document these things, right? I don't know if you ever cataloged them, but you do have them in a catalog. So, I mean, the ones that you've taken photos of. So,
yeah.
And nobody was doing that.
So, no, and I get emails from Europe and Japan that always want to buy these shadow photographs to this day. In fact, lately it's been even more popular than ever. And in the catalog, I started incorporating Hamilton's shadows into my wall works because since I took the photographs and I'm making the walls, just like I incorporate all the other street art and graffiti into my walls, I thought, well, why don't I include Hamilton's? Because they were on the walls and I'm making the walls. So, and I took the pictures, the shadow photographs. Mm-hmm. So I included them in my walls. I'm trying to find, and also they're life size. These constructions are kind of life size. And they look, again, they're like ripped out of a building. The walls are just ripped out of a building. And these are the three I'm showing. I was invited to show these three pieces in the Hamilton retrospective. Oh. I'm the only other artist in his retrospective other than him, because a retrospective is usually one artist. So I'm really thrilled and excited to have these pieces included into his retrospective.
Yeah, that's interesting, because these are, in a sense, not authentic. They're your interpretation of what he was doing, in a sense, and they're your pieces, and they and they are artifice, pure artifice. They're not real walls, you know. So it's very interesting that he's willing to do that.
Well, he's dead, the artist. He died a few years ago, and I don't know what he would think of these pieces, but in a way I'm promoting him as well, you know, as myself. I'm just taking, rather than taking my shadow photographs, which they were done in public domain, so anybody can photograph them and pretty much do whatever they want with them. It's public domain. And I did it as a historical documentation, because none of those paintings, those wall paintings, exist. They only exist in my photographs. So they are historical. They're not just pictures. They're historical, just like the cave paintings, you know? Anyway, I just married the two series, you know. I married the nightlife Hamilton shadows with the Frank Pelaya wall constructions, put them together, and it's a perfect marriage, because they make the Hamilton shadow look more realistic, and they make my wall look more realistic. So it's a perfect perfect marriage. And I did the same thing with graffiti artists. There's a series in the catalog of quite a few graffiti artists, well-known graffiti artists, that did their tag on my walls.
Yeah, you were working right through that whole period when graffiti artists really came up.
Kind of in the beginning, in the early 80s, I did these collaborations with Crash and Daze and Riff and Coco and Phase 2 and Tracy 168. These are all very well-known graffiti artists. And they did their tag on my wall. And again, it made their tag look more realistic, and it made my wall look more realistic. So it was a perfect marriage. As a matter of fact, speaking of Warhol and graffiti and walls, I was watching the Warhol Diaries on Netflix. It's an interesting series. It's six episodes of his life, Andy Warhol's life, from 1977 to 1987, when he died. It's really good, very intimate portrait of him as a human, not just as an artist. And I'm actually in a couple of scenes, because there is a scene of there's sort of an aerial photograph of a group show in Soho in 1982. It was one of the very first graffiti shows, and I was in it. I had one of my big wall pieces, simulated wall pieces, in the show, because it had graffiti on it. And so for just like 3 seconds, you could see me. I'm in the crowd, and you could see my sculpture. I was really surprised. My friend saw it and told me on email. They said, "Frank, have you seen, you're in the Warhol Diaries series?" I said, "No, I didn't know that." So I watched, and sure enough, I was there. Who knew 40 years later that it would be, no.
But you did have some interaction with Basquiat. Yes, you mentioned
Basquiat,
it in the catalog. Yeah,
Jean-Michel Basquiat, yeah. You see, these all are kind of connected, you know. I had a show in a small little print shop in Little Italy on Mott Street in 1982, I think. And I had, it was just a little show of my little wall constructions, you know. And the owner, I went into the shop, and the owner said, "You know, Frank, Basquiat was in here the other day, and he really likes your work." I said, "Oh, well, that's interesting." He was just starting to get well known. He was kind of known as Samo, you know, that was his tag, S-A-M-O. Supposedly it stood for same old shit, you know, but anyway. So I thought, "Oh, okay, well, that's interesting." And around this time, I was already collaborating with the other graffiti artists, Crash and Daze and those guys. So I said, "Okay, well, that's interesting." So I got his phone number, Basquiat's phone number, and I called him up, because his studio was right in Soho on Crosby Street, just two blocks from this print shop, because Basquiat used to make a lot of color Xerox copies, and he incorporated them into his paintings. So anyway, I called him up, and I said, "Yeah, hi, I'm Frankie. You saw my work at Todd's Copies. And, you know, would you like to collaborate?" Because I was collaborating with the other artists. He said, "All right, sure, bring a piece over." So I brought a big wall piece over to his studio. Anyway, make a long story short, so I go up to his studio. It's a total disaster. His studio was unbelievable. I never saw anything like it. I mean, it was, I'm not kidding. It was about ankle deep in just junk, trash, garbage, chicken bones, you name it. And the paintings are all over. His paintings are on the floor. I was walking on his paintings and he didn't care. You know, he didn't care about a lot of things, but he was still a very interesting, exciting young artist. I think he was only 22 or 23 when I met him. Anyway, he said, okay, leave your piece here, you know, and then when I'm done doing something, I'll come and get it. I said, great. So I go home. About a month goes by. He didn't hear anything. So I call him up and I said, Jean-Michel, did you do anything with my wall? And he said, no, I didn't, Frank. Come on over. I have to talk to you. Mm-hmm. So that didn't sound good. So I went over there and I looked at my wall and, you know, he hadn't touched it. And I said, what happened? He said, well, my dealer, Mary Boone, who was like the biggest, hottest gallerist at the time, he was preparing for his big, not his first show, but his first really major solo show at the Mary Boone Gallery, which was a big deal. And she must have talked to Basquiat and she said, you know, you're not a graffiti artist anymore, so you can't do that, you know, stuff. So he didn't do it. So, but I think he felt bad and he said, okay, I'll tell you what, Frank, why don't you make a couple of little paintings for me? I said, oh, okay. What do you want me to paint? And he looks down at his littered studio and he picks up two pieces of scrap paper and he says, here, paint these. So one was a parking stub about 3 inches by 3 inches. And the other one was a flattened out toothpaste box. I said, you want me to paint these? He goes, yeah, how much you want? So, I mean, you know, this is all, you know, new. I didn't expect any of this. So my head is like spinning. Like, gee, I don't know, what do I want for these? So while I'm thinking, the phone rings, he answers the phone and it's Warhol, of course. And, you know, they were best buddies at this time. And Warhol wanted to play racquetball. And Jean-Michel didn't want to do that. So he's talking. And I'm looking on the ground through all this litter because it's interesting. And I see two checks made out to him. One was for $5,000. The other one was $8,000, which doesn't sound like much, but this is 1982.
Oh, yeah. That is a lot of money.
40 years ago. So these were equivalent to about $30,000 and $25,000. So I picked them up. When he got off the phone with Warhol, I said, here, you might want to keep these checks. He took them and he just kind of threw them on the table. So he says, yeah, okay. So how much do you want for those little paintings? So while I'm thinking, I guess I was taking a long time to come up with a price. He reaches behind his chair, which wasn't really a chair, it was a car seat. He pulls out a piece of wood and he goes, here, Frank, you want this? And I looked at it and it was a little Keith Haring painting. And I probably should have taken it, but I didn't. It was not a very good one. And also remember, Keith Haring was not the big deal that he is today. He was just this punky kid going around scribbling on the walls. So I said, oh, okay, 500 each. Okay. Now remember, 500 is equivalent to about 1500 or 2000 now each. So I thought, well, that's take me maybe an hour to do each one, that they only were this big. So he goes, okay. He reaches into his pocket, pulls out five crisp $100 bills, and he fans them out, you know, like playing cards. He goes, here, this is the deposit. When you finish, come back and I'll give you the rest. Okay. So I go home, I paint the little paintings, and then I go back, but now he's at a different studio. It's not on Crosby, it's on Great Jones Street, which is a bigger studio that Warhol got for him because I think he owned the building. And so I brought the paintings there and I gave them to him. It was very chaotic in his studio because they were wrapping his paintings for the Mary Boone show. And so I couldn't really talk to him very much. I just gave him the paintings and he paid me the rest. And that was it. And then, of course, I went to his opening at Mary Boone, which was maybe a week or two later. And because I feel, oh, now he's my best buddy, you know. So there he is. I went early to the opening because I wanted to talk to him, you know, because it gets crazy. And so he was there with Warhol, of course, next to him. So I met him. He just was standing there like a mannequin. He didn't say anything, which is what he usually did. So I think I gave him one of my books. My Great Walls of China book had just come out. And so I gave him, because he likes walls too, because he was kind of like a graffiti, almost like a cave painter almost, with his crude style. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I gave him my book, and then he gave me his autograph, and that was it.
Oh, interesting. And then really
five years later, he died. And
So
that's my little Basquiat story, which now that I think about it, it's kind of amazing. I wish he had paid me with his artwork, you know, instead of just money. And I also should have kept, and I didn't keep the little scraps of paper that he gave me to paint. I don't know why I didn't keep those. They're in my catalog. Actually, the two paintings I thought should be in the catalog. Here they are. It's the painting stub here. And then this is the toothpaste box. And it's from Thailand. I don't know how he got that. Yeah. But anyway, that was the consolation prize because he couldn't collaborate on one of my walls.
Yeah. If only we could go back. I had a friend in the Yale Art Library who was there when Matthew Barney was a student there, and Barney gave her one of his works as a kind of parting gift when he left. Matthew and she kept it on a shelf in her office for a long time. And then it just creeped her out, she said. So she threw it in the dumpster. Behind the art library. And and she said, I could have retired on that if only I had known.
I know.
So you mentioned China and the Great Walls of China. So at this point, you'd already been to China. So the question is, what made you want to go to China and how did you get there and how did that come about?
So in undergraduate school, I had a very good painting teacher, and he also taught Asian art, contemporary art and Asian art. And he really made Asian art really interesting. And this is 1981. This is just a few years after Mao died. He died in 76. And China was just like opening up a little bit. You know, you could actually go there. Deng Xiaoping was the leader at the time. And he was a little bit more liberal than Mao. He kind of was a little bit of a closet capitalist. You know, I forget his saying, but it's like making money is a good thing or something like that. So my painting teacher organized this trip to go to China with about 25 people. He advertised in the New York Times, and people from all over the country responded, and he got the 25 people because you could only go with a group in those days. You couldn't just wander around by yourself. So I thought, and I had a feeling that China, once it opens up, it's going to become modern, and it's going to be like a big giant Japan. I wasn't interested in that. I wanted to see China, the old China, the raw, dingy, you know, communist China, because I knew they were going to lean toward capitalism, which they are, that they're actually more capitalistic than we are. And I had some money because I was painting signs and making a pretty good amount of money. So I had, it was $3,000 in 1981. That was the cost for the airfare, the guide, the food, the hotels, the whole bit, which was kind of a lot of money, but it was equivalent to, I guess, like $9,000-$10,000 now. But I thought it was worth it. And it was worth every penny. We went to dozens of places, six or seven cities. It was almost a month trip. We had guides. We went to museums and farms and schools and colleges and galleries and communes and all kinds of places, and met really interesting people. And it was surprisingly loose. I mean, I could walk around. I took hundreds and hundreds of photographs, and I made the book, The Great Walls of China. Again, I photographed the walls, the murals, the billboards, the signs. There was no graffiti, so none.
Yeah, but there was advertising, right? It wasn't.
Yeah, there was plenty of that. In fact, it was the most colorful thing in the whole landscape, were the ads and billboards, because everything else was gray and brown, and that's it. You know, I mean, just think about this. When I was there, there was not one private car out of a billion people, not one. No McDonald's, no Hilton hotels, no, none of that, you know, no litter because they didn't have fast food, and just oceans and oceans of people and bicycles. I mean, that's pretty much all you saw. There were a few cars here and there, but they were only for diplomats and, you know, that kind of thing. And of course, we went to the Great Wall of China, which, you know, I walked on and how many miles in both directions. They had like an easy way to walk on the wall and then the hard way. Mm-hmm. Most of the group went to the easy way. I did both because I was so excited. And it was during the month of July, and it was the hottest weather I've ever experienced. It was 100. Every day and humid. I think I lost about 10 pounds just from sweating. And I didn't include the Great Wall of China in my book on purpose because, you know, it's kind of a typical cliche thing. And I wanted to focus on the other kinds of walls in China, not the Great Wall, which everybody kind of knows what it looked like. Yeah. So I purposely didn't put that in there. And that's why it's titled The Great Walls of China.
Mm-hmm. And basically it's photographs of
everything else.
Really interesting. Yeah. So,
and then I used some of those images for my Chinese fresco series. And these are actual frescoes.
Also and political posters, right? You've got Mao in there and
I also started my dictator series.
Interesting.
Got Mao and Chung Ching, who is, that's his wife. She was the head of the Gang of Four. I don't know if you remember the Gang of Four.
Yeah.
They were pretty awful. And then these are the advertisements. This was a social political thing, you know, a happy young lady with flowers, and China is, you know, is a wonderful place and people are wonderful here and we have a great country. You know, that's the, I used my sign painting skills for the lettering. See, all this stuff comes in handy, you know. And what I loved about these ads is that they look like they were from the 1950s. Although now it's 1981. So yeah, they're kind of 30 years behind.
Yeah. Interesting that they're selling Argyle socks in China.
I know. And nobody, I didn't see one pair of Argyle socks because it's 98 degrees. You don't want to wear Argyle socks. Sure, you know, here's some more Chinese frescoes. And I submitted these to when I applied for the Rome Prize. And this is, I got the Rome Prize on these Chinese frescoes.
Okay. So that's how you got to Italy then. You got the Rome Prize. So you went to the American Academy in Rome. For some time, right?
Well, 1 year. It's probably the best thing an artist can get. It's not like a regular grant. They don't just give you a check and say, good luck. They give you a check every month and a place to live in a beautiful palazzo in Rome.
Yeah.
You got three meals a day. You have airfare, round trip airfare, travel money, art supplies. I mean, you name it. It's like a dream. It's a dream thing to win as an artist. And I loved every minute of it. And it got me really hooked on Italy. And I've been there at least 20 times. In fact, I just came back a few weeks ago from Rome. And I had an extra bonus because I met my wife, who
Dauber was there studying at the American Academy.
She got the Rome Prize in art history. And you're right. You said that her name would come up later, and sure enough,
So
anyway, a long story short. So we met and we got married in Rome, and I think we were the only fellows to ever meet and get married.
Oh, that's interesting. Year,
the American Academy in Rome, and we have our little wedding pictures in their big, big Academy book that they have. Yeah. We got married in the Capitoline Museum. It was really beautiful. And then, you know, I thought it was kind of funny. Rome, a city with 500 churches.
You didn't get married in a church. You got married.
We didn't get married in a church. You got married in a museum.
Yeah. Well, she is an art historian. So, and
And I'm an artist. And the Capitoline was designed by Michelangelo. So, it's a really nice, perfect little marriage there.
Yeah. Interesting. And then this stuff, I can see it influences your fresco art really wonderfully, doesn't it? Because this is a place where wall art is like really important, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And that's how I got, in fact, my proposal when I applied for the Rome Prize, you have to have a proposal. You can't just say, just want to be in Rome. You know, that doesn't cut it. You have to have a specific reason why you want to be in Rome. So my proposal was I wanted to do fresco painting, but not a traditional fresco painting. I wanted to do dry fresco or secco fresco, painting into dry plaster, and not painting angels and saints, but painting contemporary images. So that was my angle, and I guess they liked it, and that's where I got the prize.
So a lot of your imagery comes from Italian advertising here, doesn't it?
Yeah, I did a whole Italian series, you know, with, again, contemporary images that I would accumulate and compile from Roman streets and Italian.
Which is very different from Chinese advertising. I mean, this is very Fellini-esque. I mean, the whole
And they're all in the book here. Yeah. I have quite a few of the Italian ones. And here's one right here. Yeah. This is a pretty big one, 4 by 6 feet. Uh-huh. And it's about almost a foot thick. And part of it is a fresco. This part here mm-hmm. is actually a dry fresco of an old communist political poster. The Communist Party PCI, was big in those days. And then this side of the piece is mostly collage with actual posters that I ripped off the wall and then attached here, along with a lot of paint and mixed media. So, you know, it looks like it was just ripped out of a building.
So you also have in your book a series on the Berlin Wall.
I did a whole series of Berlin Wall pieces. In fact, I did a whole installation show in Soho, a solo show of my Berlin Wall pieces. Again, they were all simulated. Mm-hmm. And everybody that came into the gallery thought, oh, wow, they see the work. And they go, oh, I didn't know the Berlin Wall came down. I'm not kidding. I mean, everybody thought they were the real Berlin Wall because they were I made them life size. They were this thick, you know, 10 inches thick.
This was before it did come down. Right?
This is two years before the wall came down.
It was prescient.
And they're in my catalog too. I have several pieces. And I was amazed. You know, I went to Berlin when I was in Rome on the Rome Prize. I went to Berlin to photograph the wall because I knew I wanted to do another wall series. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, why don't I do the Berlin Wall? And so, you know, these are massive, almost a foot thick. And again, they look like they weigh 1,000 pounds, but mm-hmm. they weigh maybe 10 or 15 pounds. Mm-hmm. And then I even have some standing sculpture here. Like this is West Berlin, full of graffiti. And then this is East Berlin, just blank white. Yeah. I added Gorbachev's picture there, but of course his picture is not really on the wall. And then I put bullet holes. Because, you know, if you go near it, you literally were shot. And then here's some barbed wire. So this is a freestanding Berlin wall.
Oh, I see. Yeah. My favorite work in your artist book show was the coloring book that you did on from the Berlin Wall that you'd actually taken from the wall itself. Right? That was really brilliant idea.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. That was fun. Yeah. I took my photographs and then I traced the graffiti and left them blank inside and then made pages. And then I taped the pages together in accordion style. Mm-hmm. And so the coloring book was, you would fill in all the colorful graffiti on the west side of the Berlin Wall. And then once the coloring book was filled in, most coloring books, when they're all filled in, you throw them away. There's nothing to do. But mine was the opposite. Mine was sort of like a finished piece of art and you would keep it. And so, and it would actually stand up because it was an accordion.
Interesting.
So you sort of created your own little Berlin Wall.
Yeah. Interestingly, you know, I'm thinking of Trump and the border wall, but maybe the beginning of the dissolution of the wall is the artwork that people feel they need to paint or apply to the wall, which was the case with the Berlin Wall. I mean, there was plenty of graffiti on that wall, at least on the West Berlin side, before it came down. And there are works of art that are on the border wall already, you know, with Mexico. So,
And also, you know, Banksy's has done a lot of wall work on the Israeli wall, Palestinian wall.
Yeah.
And and then also the artist JR, he's fantastic. He does those big black and white portraits on walls all over the world.
Art is about connecting people, not dividing them. So
In fact, JR did a piece a while ago where he photographed Palestinians and placed the big portraits on the Israeli side. And then he photographed Israelis and put their pictures on the Palestinians.
Oh, interesting. Beautiful idea. Yeah. So.
Yeah. That was about 10 years ago, maybe. Yeah. I mean, you know, also walls divide and they also connect. One end of the wall connects the other end, but it also divides. So it does a lot of things.
Well, they also, they hold up the roof and they give us shelter, don't they?
Yes. Oh, one other thing. I wanted to be an architect. That was sort of what I wanted to do. But I didn't receive very good guidance in the younger grades. Mm-hmm. You know, I was afraid to be an architect because I wasn't good at math. And I thought, oh, gee, what if I design a building and it collapses and then people die? And,
yeah.
You know, I'm going to go to jail. Uh-huh. I didn't realize that, you know, the engineer does that part and then the architect just comes up with it. If someone had just told me that in the beginning, I would have been. So actually, all these wall works, they're in, it's like maybe compensatory activity for me. Like, okay, I'm not an actual architect, but I'm making walls, mm-hmm. you know, I'm designing and fabricating walls. So it's my kind of cheap, easy way to be an architect, you know.
You're constructing something that we inhabit in a way. So
yeah, and you know, some of them are quite big. I have one wall in the catalog here that's 9 feet high and 16 feet long.
Oh wow.
So it's like all styrofoam, so it's not real, but it certainly looks real. It looks like it was just ripped out of a building. I think I have a picture of it. Yeah. So I guess I'm a cheap, easy architect without actually being an architect.
So am I right that over time, through these various series, your work seems to become more and more political, at least the imagery, there's more political imagery as time goes on.
Yeah, because politics gets me frustrated because there's so much awful stupidity in politics, especially since Trump came along. Now there's like a whole slew of new dictators that are like all over the place and they just are awful. Mm-hmm. One is worse than the next. I make these portraits of dictators, and Trump is one of them, and Putin, you know, the whole gang. I did Duterte, Bolsonaro, I'm going to do. I mean, there's so many Mao, of course, and Stalin. So they're just awful people. They do just terrible things. And so, you know, usually leaders love to have portraits of them, you know, and they're all over the country. But my portraits are the opposite. I'm not praising them. I'm actually trying to tear them down.
Well, it looks like time has intervened here in all of them, the way you do these frescoes, because they look old, you know. So for me, there's this Ozymandias element where sooner or later, these people go by the wayside and so do their images. Yeah.
Right. So here's the Trump dictator portrait. And, you know, it's riddled with holes and bullet holes. And these are about 60 MAGA hats, but with different messages, the true messages that should have been on the MAGA hats instead of Make America Great Again. Things like cheat on your taxes, cheat at golf, you know, denigrate Jews, you know, all those things. Yeah. And then Putin, I'm putting Putin in my Beacon show, which I have
opened
in about a
very
week.
Very timely.
Yeah. And it opens May 14th at the Hudson Beach Glass Gallery in Beacon on Main Street. Yeah, and the same thing with his portrait. It's got bullet holes. Oh, I did. Here's Stalin, Putin. You know, he's got his shiny gold leaf medals, but he's got bullet holes riddled across. And Putin here, same thing. He's got beautiful architecture in his country, but he's such a horrible human being. And I have you can't see him here, but there are crosses here. This is sort of like a cemetery on this cliff in the back. All the hundreds of journalists and political opponents that he's killed over the years. And it's not here because I added it later. That sunken ship that the Ukrainians sank, the Russian ship that they sank.
Oh, you got it in the painting.
I painted it in here. It's not in this because I added it later.
It's a work in progress.
Here's Kim Jong-un here with, again, I combine, this is graffiti from Naples and at the bottom, and in the top half is the North Korean part with his portrait. Again, he's got the rocket, you know, Rocket Man. Yeah. He's got the rockets.
And so if someone wanted a copy of this catalog, could they get it on Amazon or would they have to write to you?
Not Amazon, but they can get it from me directly because I didn't make very many of these. I only made 150, so it's not very many. It was a lot of work. It's quite hefty too. It's, I don't know, 200 pages. 150 works.
So I'll put a link in the Library Cafe website where the podcast will be. I'll put a link to let people know where they can write if they want to get a copy of the catalog. So because it'd be nice if people could see what we're talking about.
Yeah, or just my email, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Just put my email in there.
So your email is?
Frank, spelled with a C, F-R-A-N-C, Palaia, P-A-L-A-I-A. And the number one at gmail.com.
Okay. We'll put it on the website so people don't have to remember.
Okay.
Apart from this Beacon show, do you have other shows in the offing?
Well, today is the Chase Contemporary Gallery opening of the Hambleton Retrospective.
Oh, it is. Okay.
On West Broadway from 6 to 8.
So you've got to get into Manhattan between now and then.
Yeah, I'm going to go down there.
Okay.
And, but that's going to be exciting. It's three galleries full of his work. And I'm the only, like I said, I'm the only other artist in his retrospective.
Oh, interesting.
So I feel quite honored to.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a real specialized audience because Hambleton is kind of a cult figure now. I mean, he's got such a big following all over the world. I mean, when he was alive, some of his paintings sold for $500,000 or almost $1 million. Yeah. But he was a sad, pathetic character as a person. He was a really dynamic artist, but he was a drug addict for 40 years. And then he got scoliosis and then he got cancer.
Well, it's very interesting in that you've got an artist who paints shadows on walls. So, I mean, what's more concrete than a wall and what is more evanescent than a shadow, you know? So,
yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, you can even connect it to the atom bomb in Hiroshima. You know, when the light flashed and then people's shadows actually were kind of burned into the wall.
Yeah, they do have that look about them.
They are very crude, but they're powerful. And it was such a brilliant idea to do these shadows because there's so many different meanings swirling about them, you know, like, were they him? Were they other people? Were they menacing criminals? Yeah. You know, it's just, there's so many different ideas floating around them. Yeah. And that's why I think they are still around and still popular and still sought after.
They remind me of silhouettes too, a little bit, like Kara Walker's work. She has that same quality.
Oh, and that reminds me, Richard Hambleton had an interesting little skill. He could look at you for 2 seconds, get a black piece of paper and cut out your silhouette profile like they used to do, you know, before photography. Uh-huh. He could do that in like 2 minutes and it would look just like you. So in a way it was, you know, the shadows they're just part of him, you know, anything black and image, those two things, black and image. In different materials, but the same kind of effect.
You have other projects in the offing?
Well, you know, I'm still working on some murals. I'm trying to get some new murals done this summer. You know, mural painting is just it has a time limit. It has to be between, say, May and October. So I'm trying to line up some murals for this summer.
Those are local murals. Those tend to be advertisements for businesses, don't they? Not always, but sometimes.
No, not always. But obviously, when you have a big wall, colorful painting on your store or your business, of course, it's sort of like an advertisement, even though it doesn't say it. And then sometimes I incorporate, well, like, for example, in Poughkeepsie, the Ice House.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. That's one of my favorites.
That's a combination mural and sign. Again, you know, that's why I'm so glad I have both those skills. In fact, almost all my murals have some signage lettering in them just because they're most of the time, my murals are historical. And by adding signage, it kind of gives it a period. It looks, you know, I do the style of lettering in the period of what the mural is supposed to be. Like the one in Poughkeepsie at the Mural Square, the old Main Street mural, is 7 storefronts and each one has the sign of a bit different business. And I painted the lettering in that kind of late 1880s, early 1900s.
Yeah, there's a graphic arts component here to what you're doing in a sense.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that I taught myself sign painting because and I'm painting a mural. I don't want to have to hire a sign painter to come and paint, you know, the lettering in my mural.
Yeah.
It would feel kind of silly and cheating or something. So I'm glad I can do both, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting that lettering should be so difficult. You would think the image would be especially difficult.
Well, they're both difficult, but different skills.
Yeah, set. I see. Yeah.
You know, lettering is just a steady hand. You have to have the right kind of brush, the right kind of paint, and knowledge about lettering styles. But painting murals is a whole nother ball game. It's not like painting a painting on a canvas. It's completely different. Scale is the thing that is the hard part. Yeah. But once you know how to do it, it's not really the hard part.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, so I'd like to thank you, Frank, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, Wall Works, Frescoes, Photo Sculpture, and Mixed Media, 1973 to 2021. Thanks a million for being on the show.
Thanks, Tom. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Same here. Okay.